Hello, friends. Welcome to this episode of Textual Community, a podcast that explores the task of reading biblical texts in light of the canonical collection and within a confessional community. In this episode, I talk with Dr. Jason Keyes about some of his recent research on the New Testament canon and the Book of Revelation. We also discuss the importance of our local context, the relationship between the academy and the church, the need for more pastor theologians, and the joy of reading the scriptures. Thanks for listening. Welcome, Jason. Thanks for being here. I'm glad that you have joined us on this episode. As we begin, could you tell us a little bit about what you do and some of your research interests and some of the things that you work on now?
Sure. Thanks, Chad. Appreciate you having me. Just want to say that I'm a longtime listener, first time caller to this show. So I appreciate the conversation here. Right now, about a year ago, I started working for Lifeway Christian Resources and the Bibles and References Division. So, you know, Lifeway has two kind of main publication arms within the, you know, the trade world and the scholarly world. You've got Holman Bibles, which is my area, which does the CSB Bible translation, study Bibles and whatnot. Then you've got B&H Academic and then B&H. So I started that last December. So December 15, I just made a year a few days ago, you know, the time of our recording this podcast episode. And my day so far, it kind of looks pretty much the same. I, you know, sit down and I open up all the Word documents and I just read and edit, make suggestions, make revisions. Right now, it's kind of just been focusing primarily on two different study Bibles that we're working on, trying to get one kind of wrapped up. We're near the end of that. So a lot of, you know, back and forth with general editor, suggestions, revisions, critiques and whatnot. And then I've had the privilege of working with one specific author. And that was fun, you know, getting to work on a specific project with him and tweaking, critiquing and whatnot, and just continuing to help strengthen it. So I just primarily all of my day consists of reading and reading and more reading and revising and editing and reading and reading and reading. And it's a blast, you know. It's a very, what's the right word? It's a very detailed position. And I love it. I was thinking just the other day of kind of how it's funny how the Lord led me up to this this job. When I was at seminary, I remember when we were at Fort Worth together, I think you were still there. One of our mutual friends was going to submit one of his Baptist Heritage papers to the White Papers, you know, publication, which you have one of those in there. So yeah, you know, I'll read through it, I'll edit it. And so did that, loved it. His paper got accepted to it. So that was cool. And then after I graduated, my doctoral dissertation was done. I graduated. I found out that they needed editors for these dissertations to sign off. So I thought, yeah, that'd be fun too. You know, so I did that for a little while, just keep learning and reading and whatnot. And, you know, just the Lord kind of brought all that to fruition for me. So it was a lot of fun. And I love the job that I get to stay home. My wife stays home and she homeschools our children. So we're all home together all day, and it's a blast. One of my main research areas is just kind of in the field of intertextuality, or if you don't like that term, you know, allusions or interbiblical exegesis or echoes or, you know, whatever term that you want to use. I'm particularly interested in just seeing how one author uses another text, not directly quoting them, but, you know, developing an image or borrowing a word or phrase and then applying that or using that within its own specific situation. And I think a lot of that comes back probably just from college when I started reading the Bible more seriously. And, you know, I was taking a class with your colleague, Mike Shepherd, and it was on the Pentateuch. You know, he was going through all the different poems within the Pentateuch, and it was just almost like his offhand comment. But he made a comment about Isaiah reading the book of Moses. And I was 19, 20 years old at that time. And I don't think anybody had ever pointed that out to me. And I just remember being floored that a prophet is reading another book within, you know, how we would understand within the Bible itself. Mm-hmm. You know, and then as you read and you continue to study, you see that more and more and more again. You know, you've got the minor prophets are doing the same thing. They're, you know, just like Isaiah, they're borrowing the Exodus images. Isaiah's using it for a new Exodus motif. But that started something for me, that this book that we have is much more complicated and much more intricately detailed than what I had originally thought. And so that, I think that kind of started the journey, which, you know, we'll talk about my book later on, but I think that that was kind of the foundation for it, was seeing that how the biblical authors actually use the book or a book in referencing. So that's one of them that I've find a lot of fun. Another one has been now lately, post 5 years of doctoral research, has been getting back into the canon and canon hermeneutics and structures and whatnot. You know, when I did my dissertation, that's all I did was read that. And so I kind of got burnt out on it for a little while and I put it to the side, but I've slowly been kind of reintegrating it back into my just reading habits and whatnot. So canon hermeneutics, mm-hmm. and just structure, how structure influences emphasis and interpretations and whatnot. Another one I don't write on as much yet, I hope to in the future, is just kind of bridging the gap between the church and the academy and seeing how the academy can influence the church and then vice versa. So, you know, I was in pastoral ministry for, I think, 9 years, 8 or 9 full-time years before I started this position at Lifeway. And so it was just within the, you know, within ministry and then just the daily grind of that, knowing that I had this interest in academic side of studies. And now that I'm kind of back into that role of the academic guild, trying to still figure out how this works, you know, specifically within my Sunday school class that I teach. The last one I've gotten to write on once, and I've published an article in the Orleans Journal. It was a lot of fun. It was on Wendell Berry. And so, like, I've started reading a lot of Wendell Berry back in 2019, and just his view of localism, community, and staying rooted. You know, Berry's a farmer, poet, essayist, lobbyist. What? No, not a lobbyist. That wouldn't be the right word. All kinds of different IST fixes on there, but just a small town, rural farmer in rural county, Henry, Kentucky. But his books have been very, very helpful for me as someone who's moved back to his hometown too. And just thinking of what it means to be rooted in a community, and specifically within the community of my hometown, to be rooted back into my home church, and how can I serve the people best here? You know, and it's helped us to thinking of growing on food and gardening and homesteading and raising chickens and cattle and whatnot too. So, yeah, kind of those big, broad ranges of topics.
Okay. Yeah. Great. And as you've described your current position, you've had to kind of use, as a editor, an academic editor in some ways, using both, some academic training, but also ministry focus. As you're thinking about, both of those contexts, a major topic that we talk about all the time here is the relationship between the academy and the church in big terms, but also like in the, not only the big concepts, but also the tasks of the academy and the tasks of the church and how they come together in a particular ministry situation or vocation. So what are some of the things that as you've participated as a, you know, you've preached and taught in the church, you've done, you know, academic work in your dissertation and things of that. And then now you're as an editor. What are some of the challenges that you see and rewards of trying to bridge this gap? Because it clearly needs intentional work, but also is difficult to kind of bring those together in a particular way. So what are any the discussions recently in the last 10 years, too, of thinking about what a pastor theologian is, depending on how you kind of think through both the church and the academy? What you think of as a pastor theologian might look different as well. But what are some of the ways that you've seen that in your own ministry, but also just in general, as you're thinking about the challenge and reward of being a pastor theologian?
You know, I think the first and primary goal for a pastor working as a pastor theologian is to help his people read the Bible. You know, and that sounds so cliche and it sounds so, you know, rudimentary or whatnot, but I think the reality is if pastors knew how little congregants probably read their Bibles, it would be very disheartening to them. So it's, you know, I think one of the primary goals that I tried to do within the ministry, within being a full-time pastoral ministry, and then even now, what I'm trying to do when I preach or, you know, I'm teaching Sunday school on a regular basis, is to help my people understand the need for them to read the Bible, right? And I feel like, I think if we can get them to that part of helping them to see, kind of like what it was done for me with Shepherd and with, you know, Chuck Quarles and all those other guys, of just seeing how beautiful the Bible is, how intricately woven together it is, all the various themes and topics, right? That it's much more than the instruction manual before leaving Earth, you know, something like that old acronym. But like it's a story that is woven together for the purpose of our good and for His glory. I think if we can get them to understand that a little better than maybe what we've done, then we can help them to read it better. Mm-hmm. You know, and then we begin to equip the people to read it better. I think the works that, you know, the Center for Pastor Theologians have done within the past 10, 15 years has been good. You know, when I read that book, Pastor Theologian by Wilson and Heisten, it was like, this is kind of what I've been looking for. And I remember reading that the first time and thinking, like, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. Trying to bridge the gap of solid, robust theological education within the local church versus what I got when I was younger, growing up in the church. This is how it could be done. Now, you know, I might quibble with some things, what they had proposed. I do think that kind of this local and public theologian is a good model. Especially mostly in a rural area, because a lot of it's difficult for rural churches to spot a pastor nowadays. Mm-hmm. But just having a guy come in and love the people and teach them the Bible, and show them how doctrine works and show them how it applies their lives is very helpful. Now the challenges are, there are many. Because there's a lot of men who are laboring diligently, who are it, right? They're their only, the sole staff member, sole administrator, sole counselor, sole preacher, sole whatever, and so time is against them, in a lot of those things. And you know, just within the local church too, of thinking of bridging in to smaller. I should say it from this way, from my personal experience. Let me phrase the topic this way. From my personal experience and the research that I've done within rural congregations where I live, or just small ones, like it's very difficult for a pastor to kind of go in and to begin trying to help shape a congregation for a biblical worldview rather than these topical sermons that kind of jump all over the place that the congregation has been fed for 70, 80 years. Now, I'm not saying that the Lord can't use that, of course, but I think a robust, steady diet of preaching consistently from the Word through books of the Bible is a healthier model. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to do that because you get pushback immediately. And so, but the pastor theologian is just one who stays the course, right? He loves the people, and this is where a lot of Winterberry is coming to play for me. Like the trajectory for most pastors has been 1 to 3 years in the church. They meet that offense, or they meet the defense and the pushback, and then they leave. But the pastor theologian, I think, who can stay, and Barry's been helpful here, of just staying within the community, being rooted within this church, loving these people, understanding that, you know, pushback's going to come, and it very well could be your fault. You could have been a jerk about it. You should have been nicer, something like that, right? That those communities and those congregations can thrive if the pastor is willing to put in the work to exposit the text weekly, mm-hmm. and honestly just love the people. Now, the another issue is too, you know, for guys who go into the pastorate who have a research degree, an advanced degree, like a doctor, a PhD, they're still kind of wanting to bridge that academic guild. And so this is kind of what a lot of what the pastor theologian model is, according to the Center for Pastor Theologians, you know, of still being able to breach that academic guild to write towards them, not necessarily specifically only for them, And I would say, you know, it's possible to do that. A lot of what I found, the articles that I've been fortunate to write and contribute and have published, have all come out of either a sermon or a Sunday school lesson. Mm-hmm. I have one I'm working on now that was from a guy who just brought up an interesting question. I'd read this text. It's kind of like what your last episode with Ben Glad was on, like a student asked a question, like, I've not considered that or something.
Yeah.
Or preaching. It's like, man, I haven't thought about that. Well, the student like just randomly, or this person in class just randomly said this phrase. And I had taught on this text before and I'd preached this passage before. Thought I'd never heard, like, I never thought about that. And so it's just something to continue to explore and investigate. But I would say, like, for the guy who wants to go in and be a pastor theologian in the sense of preaching and still contributing to academic guild, one of the ways to do that is just continue to teach, make notes, put them to the side, and then just kind of see what the Lord may do for that.
Yeah. Well, and I like the even just thinking about your emphasis on, like, Wendell Berry and, like, localism. Recently, for thinking about the pastoral task of the organic metaphors have been so helpful of being rooted, or even just this idea of cultivating something. It takes time and it takes longevity in a particular place for you to see. Just even like when Paul combines in 2 Timothy 2, when he's saying pass on what you've heard from me, pass on to others who can teach also. Then he gives those metaphors of a good soldier, and then also a runner in a race. But then he combines that with the farmer, the patience that's required here, as you plant seeds, but then you have to tend them, and you have to take care of the area, and then you have to wait, and you have to. So sometimes that task looks a little bit different. And I think sometimes, as you've talked about, and you just mentioned some of the theory, the ideal of, like, bringing together, like, someone preaching these pristine sermons and this amazing sermon series, but also, like, publishing a series of books and then bringing all those together. It's like, that can just be overwhelming. And I think the typical pastor is just tired, you know, because especially in rural congregations where they're just the only major staff person. So I like the idea of not necessarily thinking of the academy and the church as these huge entities, but rather like academic tasks and practices and habits that are usually associated with the academy, being able to integrate those. Like, somebody asks a question about gender or sexuality or intertextuality or any of those, topic. Well, you have to, you know, use the skill that you learned in academic work. Like, what are the major issues? What are the underlying concerns? And then to communicate in, you know, either do your own research, or a lot of times it's giving essentially a targeted, accessible, annotated bibliography for someone to kind of work through and respond to. And to do that well, that takes quite a bit of academic skill, but also pastoral wisdom to know, how much of this conversation does this person need to have? Do I just need to connect the dots, or do I need to get into the whole discussion? I think there's a lot to work with there, beyond just the biggest categories.
Yeah, and I think I was thinking this morning of, and I don't know the answer to it. It's something that I'd hope to look into. But I think there's a reason why there's so, besides the fact that, you know, the world or the Bible is an agricultural world, but there's also, I think, a reason why the image of the farmer or agricultural illustrations are used, because it takes time. Right. So, you know, for example, so for us, we've been kind of on this quote unquote homesteading journey since like 2019. We kind of piddled around with gardening. This past year, like, one of our goals was to see how much food we could grow for a year. And like, we've had this massive drought and all these crazy wildfires in our areas. So it was very difficult to grow any food this summer. But we've been working this land since 2019. So it's coming up on 5 years now next year. The first year's harvest, you know, it's always great because the ground hasn't been worked and the soil is still fresh and good. That second year is a lot thinner. If you don't care for it and provide it with the right nutrients, like it doesn't recover. And so that's what we've seen. Like we finally go into year five now. We've seen that turn now from it hasn't been producing as much now to now it's getting back to a healthy state. But it's taken 5 years. I think it's the same for just for pastors and, you know, for Sunday school teachers as well, or, you know, men or ladies who have been just faithfully plodding away, teaching for years. It takes time and it takes knowing your people. What can they handle at this moment? What can they not? And even like in a public room, in a classroom setting too, the same thing is how. You know, when you get the question, some question that intensifies the room, everybody kind of tenses up. Like, how do you handle that with grace and hopefully that the person doesn't take it wrong and that they continue to come back? You have to be there and you have to know the people, right? I think too, like you had said with combining sermons, you know, into like these pristine work, like that also takes time, and so. Not necessarily that every pastor is supposed to sit down and write books. I don't think that's ever the goal. But if there's something that this, you know, he is very interested in, I think it's wise just to take it and, you know, kind of what the whole Cal Newport's thing is, this slow productivity thing of just slowly plodding away at it. You know, knowing that it's going to take you years, but it's worth just plodding away within the biblical text. So, you know, I give this for my example. When I started, one of the good things that I've enjoyed in ministry was I started teaching a Sunday school class. And man, I love that. So like we've gone through the first book of the Psalms. I've taught through First Thessalonians. When I started Lifeway, I took a 3-month time off just to kind of get my boundary, you know, my boundaries right with the job. But we started Genesis 1, the Sunday after Easter. And I was taking an interim and I took a 2-month interim in November. And so like I had to finish the end of chapter 3. So like, I mean, from April to November, we were just in the first 3 chapters of Genesis. I mean, for several months, we were just in the first chapter, right? But it's a slow plod of just slowly taking the people through the text. But for me, it's been good because I've spent a lot of time with the text of Genesis. And Genesis are probably already my favorite book, but just being able to spend time on it and just think about it has been so good just for my own soul as well. Yeah. So it's this sense of slow plodding that I think is helpful, not just for the pastor theologian, but for, you know, for all of us. Mm-hmm. Just slow down.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good. I thought a few people have said this, but one of the ones that said it most memorably that I remember is Mark Dever said, I remember him saying that we typically overestimate what we can do in 2 years and underestimate what we can do in 20 years. Like he's talking about at a church as thinking through that. And so I think that's a good model for scholarship as well as like just keep reading and exegeting and studying those texts, and the scholarly work will arise from that, just as the fruit of ministry, seeing the ministry of the word take root, you see that grow and develop as well. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good segue too, to though you said part of the phenomenon of doing doctoral work on something for 5 years is you look at it so many times that you don't ever want to look at it again.
No.
But earlier this year, you published your dissertation on the book of Revelation with Fontes Press at the End of All Things, identifying the ideal reader of Revelation. So one of the things that you said a few minutes ago is like, spending so much time in Genesis, a particular section, and then that's fresh on your mind. And then you read other texts, and then it becomes a it becomes something that enriches your reading. And one of the things that you're doing in your book and your study of Revelation is thinking through what are some of the things that we need to keep in mind as we're reading this particular book. So just as we get started, what would you say are some of the big ideas in this work? I won't ask you clarifying questions about particular footnotes or, you know, textual recensions or anything like that, but what would you say are some of the big ideas or central claims you make as we approach the book of Revelation?
I think probably the biggest claim that I make in the book is that you don't necessarily need to know the historical background in order to understand the text of Revelation. Now, let me qualify that. I'm not saying I think historical reconstruction or historical studies is invaluable. But what I do mean by that is that I think somebody, for the most part, let me say it this way, for the most part, just because of how complicated Revelation is and how intimidating it can be to some people. But for the most part, we can pick up the book, we can read the text of Revelation, and understand what the main message is. You know, and so the main message would be, of course, that Christ is returning again and he's going to establish his kingdom and everything will be made new and everything will be perfect. So I think that's probably the most central claim that I make, coupled with most, if not everybody who has studied Revelation, you know, if they're going to claim themselves to be an inerrantist or not, to be a believer or not, I think the majority, if not everybody, would say that the author of Revelation uses a lot of Old Testament text. So either quotations, allusions, echoes, again, whatever word you want to call that. But my central part of that is saying, yeah, that's right. But there also seems to be the instances of where he may use other New Testament texts as well, what we would call New Testament texts. And I got that idea from our friend Matt Emerson when he published his doctoral dissertation. You know, canonical hermeneutic for New Testament theology, for the most part. When I got to Revelation, it was just kind of like this, you know, how most dissertations are born is just an obscure footnote that says, hey, go look at this. That's kind of what it was for me, right? He had mentioned some potential things that R.H. Charles in his ICC commentary on Revelation had said that, you know, there seems to be sometimes when John may allude to other New Testament texts. And Matt said something along the lines of, you know, if somebody could go through these and prove it, or at least show that it's possible, that it would strengthen a canonical hermeneutic for Revelation. And so I was like, well, perfect. I'm in a dissertation phase, doctoral phase. That's what I'll try to do. So I started that, and you know, it was very interesting, just that whole process. You know, I had a lot of fun writing it after I kind of figured out how to get the ball moving in arguments and whatnot. It was a lot of fun writing it. One thing I think too that for me became even more strengthened was the fact that everybody kind of knows that Revelation is its own animal and that it's put where it is for a reason in the Bible, right? So Revelation is not like Ruth would be. You know, where the book can appear, you know, right after Judges in the Greek canon or right after Proverbs in the Hebrew canon, you know, for various reasons. If you put, you know, Revelation right after Matthew or Mark or Luke, like it just feels out of place. I think, you know, we all know that because just of the storyline. I mean, it culminates the end of all things. And so we all know, I think, implicitly why it's put at the end of the Bible. And, you know, we see all of the various Old Testament texts that are used, pictures that are used. But coupled with that, too, I think, and that I hope I argued decently or argued well, was I think by the fact that he uses other New Testament texts, that it makes sense for it to be at the end of the canon, because to understand it or to be the ideal reader of it, it's to understand everything that precedes it. So like all those 65 books of the Bible, this is how you understand this last book, right? So, you know, like I said, it's a lot of fun just getting to pick apart all the different allusions and echoes or intertextual links or whatever, and just work through this process of all these potential texts to say, you know, if we really want to understand it, the message is found within the text itself and how the text mm-hmm. is developed and functions and how it uses the other texts of the Bible.
Yeah. Yeah. You give, you note, as you're working through those textual links, the implications for, as you mentioned, the not just the content of Revelation, but its arrangement and function in the New Testament canon. Because I think Revelation is a good test case as you're thinking about the way that order and arrangement kind of affect the way that we kind of think of the broader shape of the New Testament. When someone says, well, ordering isn't as important, but then you say, well, what if, you know, let's put, you know, what if Revelation mm-hmm. came first or second? And it's like, you might not be able to make the a clear argument for the exact positioning of it, but you can, there's something other than, you know, just familiarity, but there's something fitting about it being here. And it seems like mm-hmm. it would be out of place here. And there are, as you mentioned, historical reasons for Revelation's position last, maybe the last to be written, or theological reasons, you know, it gives an eschatological mm-hmm. vision of the end, but you're also saying that there's a hermeneutical or textual reason that this is a fitting place to think about the function of Revelation.
Yeah, and I think a lot of it is just in how the book itself ends. I mean, it is not a copy and paste of the first two chapters of Genesis, but it is very, I mean, it's it. Like, it seems, you know, again, as we're teaching through Genesis, I have that on my mind a lot. And I don't remember who said it, but it was along the lines of like the latter things are going to look like the former things. Right? Mm-hmm. There's too many, and you know your appendix in your book pulls this out very well. Like 21 and 22 of Revelation are pretty close to 1 and 2 of Genesis. Right? It's the fact that since chapter 3 of Genesis, we have gone east of Eden. Humanity has gone as far, you know, far from God. But God has not left us alone, and that's been the whole process of the story of how does mankind then dwell with God as he did in the garden. You know, and it's through faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, it's through accepting what has been written of him, it's through the slain lamb's sacrificial gift to the people, and it's through God marrying once again the heaven and earth, but even more so this new heaven, new earth, and now, you know, we will dwell with him at the end of the days, and we will see him as he is, death's no more, and all these things. And so, but 21 and 22 tell the same story as 1 and 2, it seems like. That's where everything is headed. It's headed back to the beginning, after humanity mm-hmm. dwells with God. And, you know, if you, like you said, if you put that after John or, you know, First Peter, like it feels out of place. And so I think there's theological reasons and there's hermeneutic reasons. I think the how it ends is intended for us to remember the beginning, because that's where the storyline of the Bible goes.
Yeah, and that those last two chapters, that's a fascinating case study as well, to see some of these things kind of slamming together, because those connections are textual, intertextual. There's also theological, major theological. Central themes like tabernacle, temple, holy of holies, garden, revelation, all of those things coming together mm-hmm. where you see this in other texts in the New Testament, but there's something about the way that Revelation ends and develops that just take this into a almost a higher plane in some ways.
Yeah. Yeah. Then you've got, you know, the development of the trees again. And then the waters again. It's a beautiful scene. It's a beautiful scene. And it's there again. It's there for a reason.
Once you note some of these connections, what are some of the ways in which seeing the fittingness of the book of Revelation in the New Testament canon help you preach and teach this book, which is oftentimes avoided or obsessed about because of these some obscure images and just this vision? There are some challenging aspects of studying Revelation studying it, writing about it, preaching about it, discussing it. So how does this, seeing the fittingness of Revelation as this, you know, capstone or concluding book, how does that help us as we're thinking about our approach to New Testament theology or just thinking about the message of the book?
I think probably one of the, like you said, one of the main reasons why people don't preach this book as much or maybe teach it is likely because they're afraid of it may not be the right phrase, but I think that comes pretty close. I remember the first time, like before I preached through the book, I made the offhand comment to somebody that, yeah, I'd probably need a year's worth of, you know, time to study all the different views or whatever. But in reality, you don't need to do that. I found that as I progressed through the text and just trying as best as I can to let the text speak for itself, it was a lot easier than what I had anticipated it being. Now, you know, for the rest of my life, I have to say, people ask me like, oh, you know, what'd you write your dissertation on? I have to say Revelation. And they're like, oh, really? It's like, no, that's not what it means. You know, because a lot of the people are, they read it as, they've been exposed to the book on the sense of, we have to figure out who the dragon represents. What, who is that today? Right. So it's this newspaper reading, or I don't know, do we have newspapers today anymore? It's this news reading into Revelation that people have. And that's not at all what the text is. I think first that the thing that we need to remember is that Revelation is a text. It's a book. And it's meant to be read as a book. And so as you kind of work through it, you begin to see all the various pictures that John is drawing from, either from the Old or from the New Testament, to prove his case. You know, like you begin, when you get to, you know, chapter 5, you see the slaughtered lamb standing and victorious. Like, you know who that is, mm-hmm. But you also know he's the root. He's the lion of the tribe of Judah, which goes back to, you know, the Old Testament as well. You don't have to come down on a this is what I think about the millennial reign. This is what I think matters. This is what I think it means. This is when I think the church is going to be taken out and so on. Like the beauty of the text is that it's a text and he's borrowing pictures from the Bible itself. Mm-hmm. And so you just read the Bible into it, and you figure that out, that kind of stuff out as you go. But it's worth the effort. Like it's a beautiful book. It's a challenging book. Like I'm not saying it's, you know, it's super easy, because it demands, you know, a lot of stuff just by the fact that John doesn't stop to explain it. He just, you know, hey, here's a pregnant lady, she's giving birth, here's a dragon, and he just keeps going. He doesn't explain it. So it demands a lot from you, but the rewards that you can reap from it are for your people when you show them how to read it correctly and not be intimidated by it, not try to figure out, you know, who so-and-so is. You just let the text speak. The rewards are immense, I think, for, mm-hmm. for a believer's life.
Yeah, that's excellent. And you said, too, something we were talking about before, if the biblical authors are also biblical readers, then the concept of an ideal reader is that if the revelation of John here is expecting its readers to know some of these texts, or is writing his vision in light of these texts, then that calls us as biblical readers to also be readers of some of those same texts. Mm-hmm. And you mentioned too that it's a pretty well established that the book of Revelation is constantly drawing on Old Testament images, texts, themes, not with quotations, but allusions and strong and faint allusions to things all over the text. But also part of your major point here is that there's also some resonating connections to what becomes the New Testament collection. So as we're thinking about, we've kind of talked about Revelation 21, 22, echoing and alluding to clear parts of the storyline and the beginning of Genesis. What are some of the connections you see, or maybe just some of your favorite connections to the New Testament as you're reading Revelation? What are some of the texts that we should keep in mind as we're reading revelation in the New Testament?
I'll give you three. The first one, it's very basic, but I think it's important because I think it connects a lot of what I've been trying to say, building that argument a little. I think it connects it very well. It's the simple greeting, you know, the grace to you and peace that John uses in 1:5. I mean, it's the exact same phrase that Paul uses all throughout. I don't say all throughout, maybe it's every single one. I have to go back and check. But for the most part, it's this normal greeting. Now, you know, of course, the argument can be made, well, this is just an epistolatory greeting. This is how everybody would have made that. So there's really no connection there. But I would not discount or discredit the fact that, you know, this is one of Richard Bauckham's big points, is that, you know, Revelation has kind of this threefold genre, and one of them is epistolatory. I mean, it is apocalyptic in nature, and by its apocalyptic literature design itself, it does not require a epistolatory greeting like it does, but John includes it. And so I think, you know, whether or not he was aware of, you know, Paul's greetings and whatnot, I'm not sure if that's kind of the main point. I think it's the fact that the Holy Spirit bound that there for a reason, for us to see and connect it back to one of the other writings. And it just it introduces, much like Paul's letters does, the same, it's almost the same format of the location, who's writing to, and then, you know, chapters 2 and 3, he gets to the seven churches, and I think it would be the greeting that would have been read there as well. So that it's very basic, but I think it connects an important point for me, and just kind of thinking this through again of how significant the grace to you and peace from, and so on, identifying God as the Father and whatnot. Another one is Colossians 1:18, and then Revelation, you know, 1:5, the firstborn of the dead. John says that, the prototokos, and he says of the dead, and Paul will say that Christ is the prototokos, the firstborn, but he says ek from the dead. You know, Murray Harris suggested that, you know, this phrase prototokos ek, or just, you know, from the dead or of the dead, it signifies one or two things. It's either time or status. And so when you've got it in Paul's letter in Colossians, in that great hymn, I think it's referencing time, that it's this time that Christ died, but he is the firstborn from the dead, so he is the resurrected one. And he is the one, you know, this resurrection is different from Lazarus's, because he doesn't die again. And then you have that emphasis in Revelation 1:5, except John doesn't say from the dead, uses that prepositional phrase, but it's of the dead. Right? There's no prepositional phrase right before ton nekron to signify this exalted status. So it's like he's building on this hymn, this Pauline hymn of Jesus' status, that he is the firstborn of the dead, meaning that he has complete sovereign control and he is completely reigning over everything that's coming up. And that's the theme that is played out for the rest of the book, right? It's a very important theme. And, you know, it occurs in the fifth verse of Revelation, but it is an important theme that occurs time and time and time again as Christ. If we want to call it wages war, it's not really much of a war. You think about it, because he just speaks and everything's done. But he exercises his authority. It's also interesting, too, and I don't know if this has much of a connection with 1:5 or not, but it's the fact that all throughout the book, there are times when, you know, you see Christ is evidently, he's evidently there, he's present. You know, he's opening the seals, they're sending out they're having the trumpets blown, and he's always instituting this, issuing this. But then there also seems to be like how God is just carefully working behind the scenes, and if you're not paying attention, you might miss it. So one of my favorite ones, I guess this could be my third one, is the pictures of what I call the Holy Trinity, and then what is the Unholy Trinity. Now, I'm sure somebody said the Unholy Trinity. I'm not that creative, so I'm not plagiarizing. I'm just saying I borrow this, I'm sure, from somebody. But, you know, you've got the dragon mirroring God the Father, You have the first beast mirroring God the Son, and the second beast mirroring God the Holy Spirit. And but all three of them, all three of these characters, the unholy trinity, try to do something of their counterpart. So, you know, the first beast he has, and this is very interesting to me, he has a wounded head. And the word that's translated there is wounded. It's the same word that's to describe the slaughtered lamb standing. Right? But it appears as though it was slaughtered, whereas Christ is fully slaughtered. Then you've got the famous, you know, the 666 number, you know, the demonic number. I think that's just a play off of the perfect number, like the 777, that John is reading these things, and he's, you know, seeing this whole big picture of the perfect number being seven. You've got three, Father, Son, and Spirit, so 777, and they're just one short from the perfect number, but they're close enough that they deceive countless numbers of people. And I think that's significant. But even then, you know, the second beast is given a mouth to prophesy. Well, who's given him that mouth? I think it's a divine passive at that point, because the dragon can't create. And so, but you see how Christ is still there working constructively behind the scenes to bring about its ultimate fulfillment. I'll do one more. and we'll stop on these. Yeah. You know, you've got in Revelation 5, the trumpet scene is ending. There's loud voices in heaven. The seventh angel blows his horn. He says, the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign forever. Very interestingly, that phrase, that Greek phrase, the kingdom of the world, only appears again in Matthew 4:8, and that's the temptation scene, where the devil offers the heavens, you know, offers the kingdom of the world, shows him all the kingdoms of the world to Christ. You know, bow down, you'll have all these if you bow down and worship me, seeming like he's saying this is a shortcut to, you know, give, don't worry about the cross. This can be your shortcut.
Yeah.
And so I think that's an allusion there back to that. It's now what was promised, falsely promised, is now fully realized. And it was only by him being slaughtered and overcoming death that now it has finally been fulfilled. You know, that already not yet tension is being resolved in the 11th chapter. And I think that's important too. I think that's a key, that's a clear parallel there.
In some of the connections you mentioned, was making me think too, the connection with things like the kingdom of the world, the kingdom coming, and its connection to Old Testament books like Isaiah and Daniel in Revelation being so important, also being very important for the Gospels, those two books in particular as well. So an Old Testament connection, the use of the Old Testament in similar ways in other Old Testament, New Testament books, is kind of a New Testament connection we might not always think of, as that they're using the Old Testament in a similar way that's building on one another. And you also mentioned the way that Revelation picks up on and continues and furthers arguments and imagery from the rest of the New Testament, as you're thinking Father, Son, and Spirit, but then also just the theology of the New Testament and who Christ is being picked up and furthered. So seeing the fittingness of Revelation as part of that development. And earlier you were making the connection to Paul's letters. Here it's clearly an apocalypse with a storyline type vision, but also clearly embedded in the New Testament context of apostles sending letters to the churches containing authoritative revelation about Christ. And I've always been struck too by the fact that Revelation opens with a mini letter collection embedded in it, as which is very similar to the shape of the New Testament, that includes a story about Christ and the expansion of the church, but also letter collections from apostles, which is essentially what the shape of the book of Revelation is. So kind of that pairing and connection.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've not really thought about that. Just thinking of Paul's letters of how he would introduce it like this, and then he would go into his doctrinal, for the most part, he'd go into his doctrinal exposition and then kind of branch off into the application. Now here's kind of what you do with it within the church. You know, John kind of does like, he kind of does that in the introduction after he gets through his greeting. He expounds upon Christ as, you know, coming literally as the Son of Man. I mean, he's almost quoting Daniel 7 there, almost verbatim. And then he goes into this vision of him, you know, seeing the resurrected Christ. And the reason why he's writing it is being instructed to write these things to the churches. And it seems like at this point to give them strength to continue to stand. And then it piecemeals off to all the separate different churches. Mm-hmm. You know, and I wonder too now if somebody else could write this, if the rest of the book of 4 through 22 now is kind of like this, almost this application part of a letter. I don't know. That's something to consider.
Yeah. Well, and the connection between John's other writings, especially if you're, you know, taking the canonical signals and clues that these are texts written by the same apostle John, the relationship between the Gospel of John and the Book of Revelation has always been studied and thought about, the way, in particular, like the themes of a trustworthy witness to the Word, and then Revelation's emphasis on words, but then also the blood of his testimony, the trustworthiness of the vision, and things like that. So the links between John and the Gospel of John and the Revelation of John being significant. But I also appreciated the way that you connected some of the wording of the book to not just John's gospel, but also the synoptics, the sayings of Jesus. So even the way the book opens, these are a few of my favorite ones from your project, because it highlights some things you might have missed if you're not kind of putting them together like this. Even something simple like the opening of the book, where it says, talks about the things which must soon take place. And this, mm-hmm. you know, just a simple phrase, but this is phrases that show up when Jesus is talking about the end, the things that will take place. And then the book of Revelation positioning itself as a further exposition of some of those things, or fulfillment mm-hmm. of them. So I thought, and even just something like as simple as the book opening, blessed is the one who reads and heeds mm-hmm. or guards. Yeah. And this is, Jesus is saying some of these things in his final trip to Jerusalem in the book of Luke, where he's saying stuff like, he who has an ear, let him hear. Blessed is the one who hears, but also guards or protects these things. So some of those textual connections, or some of those connections, are not only these general connections that are, you know, theological or thematic, but there's also some textual links to reflect upon and think about their significance.
Yeah, and there may be too, just kind of making me think about that. I've preached through the infancy narratives in Luke's gospel here lately. And I was fascinated by Gabriel's pronouncement to Mary. And, you know, he basically says, you know, most English translations will translate it as, you know, nothing will be possible with God. But it almost reads something like, for nothing will be impossible from or according to the every word of God. So there's an emphasis on the word, which is what Mary picks up. And most English translations will translate it that way. May it be as me as you said, but it's may it be according to your word. You know, and like you said, with this, the words and thinking of and hearing it. Blessed is the one who reads aloud the words of this prophecy. And that may be another connection too. It's the emphasis and the focus on that God's word will not fail, that this mm-hmm. is what he has ultimately decreed. And it's wise to hear these words and yeah. to keep them, because, you know, the time is near. Blessed is the one who reads them aloud.
Yeah. Well, that's good too, is that, you know, sometimes in Advent, we forget that Advent is geared towards not only the first coming of Christ, but the second coming, as we live between the Advents. And so it's helpful and interesting to think about not only our liturgy makes that connection, but there's the structure of our New Testament is mm-hmm. connecting those things. And this is one of the means by which we will endure to the end is reflecting on these kinds of connections and connecting them to the message of the coming Christ.
Yeah. And waiting.
Yeah.
And waiting. Yeah. It's that, I think, again, it goes back to that patient farmer, the farmer who waits. It's the mm-hmm. pastor who is tilling and sowing and waiting.
Yeah. Well, that's good. We could probably keep talking about these connections for time and time and a half. As I mentioned in the last, people would stop listening probably somewhere in the middle of the tribulation of this. Well, let's
see. Hold on. What's so interesting? I don't know. Like most of your listeners know this. Like you don't do that. Like that's you. Like these puns that you do. Like that is you. You do that all the time. Like I remember in Atlanta, I think it was Atlanta. Jonathan Watson and I were sitting next to each other, and you were giving a paper. I think it was on Hebrews, and you stuck in this pun, and we just looked at each other and just started laughing. Anyway, sorry, you can cut all that out. That's fine. But no, man, it's so good how you do that.
It's a way of life. Sometimes it works. Some people love it. Some people hate it. Because obviously this spills over into teaching. And I was talking to my wife and she was saying, I was saying something like, yeah, some people hate this and some people love it. She's like, no, they don't hate it. And I said, well, I know that they do. She's like, how do you know? I was like, well, because they tell me in their student evaluations, I hate this. You know, some are like, the best part of this class was the puns and the humor. Man. And the next person will say something like, what would you change about this class? The puns and the humor, you know. So sometimes it's hit or miss.
Man, I stole one of yours the other day. My oldest was talking about reading the Bible, and I was like, "Well, you know, the New Testament says that the man has to, you know, make the coffee." Like, no, it does. Yeah, Hebrews.
Yeah,
and like she didn't catch it at first. Then she clicked. She's like, "Oh," I was like, "It's okay." I had to let that percolate for a little bit. And then my wife started laughing like, no, I took that from Chad. That's not original.
Well, when somebody realizes that's the long con, you know, when somebody realizes that they've been had and you've drawn them into this, then there's a sense of betrayal and anger that comes from that as well. So it's high risk. Maybe low, high risk, low reward, but
it's great.
It's a reward nonetheless. So
yeah, I agree. I love it.
I forgot what I was about to say. Oh, right.
Okay. Andy?
Yeah, I got you.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah, we could spend a lot more time on Revelation, but we need to wrap it up for the sake of time.
No.
I could have said that. I do like to ask this more general reflective question that there's a lot going on in our world that's discouraging, but what is something you've experienced or reflected upon recently that gives you hope?
Like I said earlier, I've been preaching through the infancy narratives of Luke's gospel. So I started with Gabriel appearing to Mary, and then Mary going to Elizabeth, and then the Magnificat. Next Sunday for Christmas Eve, we're going to look through the shepherds and all these and the birth. And one thing that before that, I preached in November, I preached through the whole four chapters of Ruth and flew through them. There's just so much good stuff in there. But one thing that I was struck by both books was how revolutionary, I should say, how revolutionary the gospel message really is. Mm. You know, so just for example, with Ruth, you know, Naomi and their family, they go, and she loses her husband, she loses her two sons. She keeps a daughter-in-law for the most part. You know, Ruth comes back with her. Call me Mara, because my life has made me bitter. The Lord has brought me back empty. But the author, you know, the narrator never calls her Mara, which is a beautiful thing. But, she, you know, through this grief and through just the daily going to the fields, you know, Ruth meets Boaz and all these things, the Lord just kind of takes care of everything without Ruth or Naomi really fully grasping the consequences of everything, you know, for the good consequences mm-hmm. for everything. you know, Naomi and Ruth, well, Ruth for the most part is, you know, she's a Moabite. She's of no rapport. She's got no money. And then Boaz still just takes her, and he's her kinsman and redeemer. And, it, you know, it's the same with Mary. You know, Mary is nobody of any worth, any significant notoriety. She had no power. She's a female this time, so she's not looked upon with great favor. You know, that's what Gabriel calls her. You found favor. There's just intense rejoicing that Gabriel brings to Mary. And then, you know, Mary's just simply humble and obedient. Sure, everything that you say, I'll do. And then she goes to Elizabeth, and Elizabeth kind of has this moment of, you know, when she hears the words of Mary's greeting, John leaps in her womb. You know, Elizabeth has been hiding out for like 6 months now. It seems like she was quarantining before everybody else was quarantined. Like, mm-hmm. She's just hid away. She doesn't want to see anybody. And she goes, she says, you know, what is this that the mother of my Lord should come to me? And the implication is, I'm the one that should be going to you. You know, when you would be blessed among the women and whatnot. Then you've got Mary's beautiful Magnificat, paralleling, I think, a lot of Hannah's song and Hannah and 1 Samuel 2. But just the Magnificat, I think it's Mary's praise to the Lord of everything that's happened, because so far within the text, Mary's only spoken to those two lines that we have until she gets to the Magnificat. So the reader is like, well, how is Mary actually feeling? And she just kind of, she blesses, extols the Lord. But the theme that runs throughout that her song is how the Lord, what Paul would say, the foolishness of God abounding the wisdom of man, right? It's just this simple fact that God chose a lowly, no-name girl, just like he chose, just like Boaz chose a lowly, no-name lady named Ruth, choosing Mary to be the mother of the Lord Jesus Christ, the Savior of the world. You know, the King, as Gabriel told her, and, you know, Jesus isn't born in a palace and a kingdom. He's not given a crown upon his head. Nobody knows who he is. You know, Caesar Augustus is out there showing the world how great and mighty he is by taking the census. And then, you know, God slowly showing his people how great and magnificent he is. Mm-hmm. And the people who worship him first in Luke's gospel are shepherds, so these unclean people that no one trusts. And then in Matthew's gospel, it's not the scribes. They just say, yeah, he's supposed to be born in Bethlehem, to the pagan philosophers, the pagan magi, when they get there. And they're the first ones who worship. And then just how revolutionary the gospel stories are. This, you know, this king never has a place to lay his head at night. He's not crowned with a regal crown. It's a crown of thorns. And I applied it in the sense of, for our people, of just how still this message is so revolutionary today that, you know, these people who gather on the Lord's Day every Sunday to hear the word sung and to hear the word preached, that is what changes the world. And it makes no sense. Like, if we were designing the story of Christmas, the Advent story, like, I don't think we would have done it that way. We would have chosen someone with prestige and power. And that's not what God did. And that's still not what God does. He chooses to use lowly people to proclaim the invaluable message of the gospel. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it gives me hope that the word is still being proclaimed and it's still being preached today. You know, and as I was studying the canon and the canon formation, kind of the tumultuous history that Revelation had getting into the canon, like, I'm amazed that we even have a Bible, just of all of the manuscript evidence and all these different things of all these manuscripts just kind of disappearing. But just the fact that God preserved that and God still preserves his church through the proclamation of the word. I think it was Luther who said that every time the gospel is preached, he pictured Jesus as walking in and among the congregation. Mm-hmm. So that's Jesus is the hope of the world. And that message is still being proclaimed. And so it's so encouraging to know that the gates of hell and Hades can never overcome the hope of the gospel that we have.
Yeah, that's a good word. It's a good word for those of us who are seeking to teach or preach the word, that the word will do its work, and it will continue to do its work. That's a good reminder, especially around Christmas time, but also in the ordinary time of the rest of the year,
when
we have to plod and plant and cultivate, as to return to the beginning of our conversation. So, well, I appreciate you coming on and chatting with us about your ministry and just some of your work, and just marveling at some of these textual connections in the scriptures.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it. It was a lot of fun.
Well, I'm glad that you're here with me here at the end of this episode. If you're still listening, you might be interested in three ways you can support me in the podcast. The first is what you've already done. Listen to this podcast. This year, I'm also writing a weekly newsletter on the canonical approach to biblical studies. So if you're interested in this, you can follow along at chedspellman.substack.com. The second way would be to read, rate, or review any of my books on amazon.com or Goodreads. These are always welcome and are very helpful. My most recent book is An Introduction to the Life and Writings of Irenaeus, an important theologian in the early church. There's a link in the show notes if you're interested. Finally, if you're so inclined, you can buy me a coffee, which is essentially a digital tip jar. Any of these tips go to offset the cost of producing this podcast. You can find a link to this option in the episode description as well. At any rate, Deo Volente, and if the creek don't rise, I'll see you next time. Grace and peace.
I regret to announce this is the end.